Jeff here. Thanks for listening. Go to playvolutionhq.com/ccbag or click the link in the show notes for the show's archives, ways to connect, ways to support the show, information about happy hour, and more. Got me a little bit flustered, so I had to start the introduction over. Coming to you from upstairs studio in the snuggery along the Gulf of Mexico with me, Tamar and Stephanie. We're back for the second part of Stephanie's early learning journey. But first, I got a story to tell. We were talking a little bit about this before we heated up the microphones. Turned 55 the other day. I've lived through it. Kind of going to be an interesting year for me. My dad was 55 when he died, and that kind of makes it a weird year for me, but I plan on muddling through. But a few days before my birthday, maybe birthday Eve, Tasha's like, I'm like, well, I turn 55 tomorrow. And she looks at me and she says, no, you don't. She just giggled from the other room. And I said, yeah, I'm pretty sure I turned 55 tomorrow. And I got up my calculator just to make sure on the phone. And I was indeed correct. And I showed her the mathematics of it. And she got this disappointed look on her face. And I'm like, you thought I was turning 54 because you think you turned 53 in September, don't you? And so she'd lost a year someplace and realized she was a year older than she thought she was. I mean, she knew, but she didn't think. Anyway, I made her older when I had my birthday. So that was a little bit annoying for her, but I thought it was hilarious.
Yeah.
To me, she will always be the almost 17-year-old that picked me up back in 1986. So hasn't aged a day in my eyes. Stephanie, all I remember about our first hour was that you used to be a hippie or hippie adjacent back in your younger days, and you lived in like a hobbit hole with a hippie guy. That was my biggest takeaway from our hour together. Is any of that accurate?
I don't remember that, but okay.
It is somewhat accurate. I wouldn't say that would be what I, if they said, what's your legacy? It would be that, but okay, that's good. It's an accurate fact.
Well, I remember when we did Tamar, she had a shepherd boy. I like the romantic entanglements. That's my favorite part of doing these. So we're picking up, I believe we're in the 80s, and you were adjudicated juveniles?
Adjudicated teens, yeah. I think the appropriate term.
Yeah,
AKA delinquents, but we don't call them that because that's a judgmental term.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, okay. So where do we pick up?
Well, I mean, so that pivot in my career actually had a lot to do with what we've been talking about, and you and I spoke about even yesterday, about my passion for development being the most important thing that we need to think about always when we're working with children of any age. I started to be part of a group that was all working at this new facility, and they spent all their time talking and drinking beer about these kids they were working with. And as they told their stories, I was working in a childcare center, and I just went, wait a minute, this is the same this is like these kids on social emotional and moral development continuum are really kind of in that 3 to 5 to 6 year old age range that I'm so familiar with. What's up with that? What's going on with their cognitive development? So I got kind of started going down all kinds of rabbit holes and decided that I really wanted to check it out and see if this was accurate and if I could do something with these older kids who clearly had a lot going on. I mean, this facility had it was residential and it had kids from I think 12 to 17. And some of them were just like dependents, like they came from families that couldn't handle them anymore, and they'd gotten into minor skirmishes with the law. So, I mean, we had murderers, we had rapists, we had arsonists, or people who had committed that stuff. So it was a real pivot for me. But what I found as I worked with them is one, it's all about relationships. And I formed close relationships with these kids and really was able to connect with them and feel like I made a difference in in their lives, maybe a little bit. At least they had some, well, they laughed and dumb jokes. But I also discovered that I was right, that they really did, a lot of them have, if you looked at developmental continuums, they really had, for whatever reason, we didn't really know at the time, had kind of stopped their social and emotional and moral development in the early childhood years. And so everything I did with them, I had a bunch of jobs over, I kind of went back and forth in the 80s between working with them in a variety of different capacities, some counseling, some education related, and child early childhood, and got the library in there at one point. But what I discovered was that when I looked through that developmental lens, it made it a lot easier for me to understand what was going on with them and to be able to hit them where they were and to promote their development, just like any other kid. And so I did a lot of things that I feel really excited about, proud of, and you know, who knows if it actually worked, but I know of one where one person is, and he's doing great, so we'll go with that. But I think I did play. We played a lot. It was the program that really nurtured play as a way of getting kids to build connections with each other, as well as the adults supporting them. I created a curriculum that was for to bring them. Almost all of them had been abused as kids. We didn't have a trauma lens at that time at all. And I've talked to former colleagues about that, that like, God, we really had no idea what we were doing compared to what we know in the field now about trauma sensitive, trauma informed, and all that. But that was undoubtedly a piece of it. But I realized that if they to break a cycle of child abuse, they needed to understand child development. So I weaseled my way into the classroom. I wasn't certified, but I talked a good game and they let me do some summer programming with these kids. And so I created a curriculum where they had to learn about child development through actually hands-on stuff. I mean, we had Play-Doh, we had sand, we had blocks, we had Legos, we had stories. I did all of those things with them. In a frame of this is how little kids develop. And then I actually, those who were ready to, who were safe to put into community centers, I had some of them placed the childcare center where I had worked, so that they could actually apply that. And so that was fun. And years later, I came back as educational supervisor. By that time, I'd really gotten deeply, deeply into fairy tales. And had been told that I thought if like I went through a Lawrence Kohlberg phase in theory and was thinking about moral development and right and wrong and justice and thought it was so very relevant to these kids because that they were in the justice system after all. And a mentor, Harry Wax, who's just an amazing Piagetian constructivist optometrist, actually, who I'd done some work with, said, "You know, you can't use Kohlberg stories with those delinquents." He said, they may have a moral development level that's low or more like young children, but they're smart and they know what people want them to say. So they're going to give you the right answers. So why don't you talk about moral dilemmas in terms of fairy t or in terms of other kinds of stories? And I went, oh, fairy tales. Well, so I did a lot of work with them one summer with fairy tales, and they ended up writing and producing three integrated plays that took common fairy tales, re-spun them on their heads, and we kind of went into and out of the woods. I think we called the whole thing and put on this big production. And again, play, pretend was at the source of it. They got to make swords. They dressed up as princesses and all that stuff, which for them was made their own costumes, did all good stuff like that. But it really gave me a way of connecting their social and emotional development with their curriculum and all that kind of stuff.
Can you say what you how did you spin them on their heads?
Okay. So they spun the fairy tales on their heads is what
Yeah,
I meant.
that's what I mean.
So example, there's a story, The Turnip, which is an Easter European story about the pulling out the turnip from the ground. And so I shared that with them. I told that to them. And this one child for boy person from who came from New York City changed it to there was a cable going down a manhole. And that was, it was the whole thing was people in the city. There was a drug dealer. There was I can't remember, a policeman. There were all these city people who were pulling this cable out of the manhole to get, I can't remember what it was at the bottom of it, but they used the classic fairy tales and reframed them from their own experiences to make them
Wonderful.
their own. And they had so, I mean, it was wonderful. It was really I mean, I had fun anyway. Hopefully they did too. But many of them had never heard the traditional fairy tales and folk tales and nursery rhymes or played. And so everything I did with them, I used what I knew about early childhood development and brought it into this adolescent setting with I think good results.
Yeah, you made it relevant to them.
Yeah, no, they made it. I couldn't not. They made everything to themselves. Egocentrism did not end at the age of five.
Well, yeah, that's for sure anyway.
Yeah, right.
And a big piece of it was you were there as an adult building a relationship with them. And my experience is that's something a lot of that flavor of young person is really lacking is those trusted relationships with adults. I mean, part of my center director days was running a school age summer program, and it was upper elementary and middle school kids mostly that were adjudication adjacent. I mean, these were kids on the brink. And our summers and after school programs were really focused on what kind of what you were doing and just being a trusted adult that they can depend on, that's predictable, and they can have a positive relationship with, does wonders for kids that are struggling.
Absolutely. And I think that this program, even though we didn't have the I mean there was a there were you know there was a psychiatrist, there were psychologists, but most of the line staff did not have a background in, I mean, you had to have a bachelor's degree, that was the qualifications, and we didn't, I mean, at that time we didn't have a lot of background in a lot of the areas that would have been relevant today, but it was relationship based. I mean, that was what, as a team, that was the whole focus was we need to build relationships with these kids and help them build relationships, healthy relationships with each other, and teach them communication skills and all of the stuff that we all honestly need. And the programs, I'm sure, has gone through many changes, but it is still in existence. So it's I feel really lucky to have gotten. And be have that part as part of my early childhood journey, because it when I went back and worked with younger children, it informed me, with because I understood that, I mean, we talk a good talk about how every child is an individual and, you know, all of this décolletage, not décolletage, décollage that Piaget talked about with, like, you're at all different levels in any individual child with their understanding or their of different aspects of their development. But I was able to really experience it with these kids who are in their teens, some of whom were classic 3-year-olds in how they approached social problem solving. And some of them, the same kids sometimes were absolutely brilliant and could, you know, like were ready for AP classes in math and yet still approach things. And so seeing that disconnect really helped me when I worked with the younger children to continue to know very strongly that I needed to look at each child as this developmental soup, or stew. And I think it helped me with my teaching of younger kids as well when I went back.
Now,
It's so
listeners are going to be.
important.
Oh, go ahead, Tamar.
I mean, that the developmental piece is just critical, and so many people are lacking in in that knowledge. It's really troubling to me, actually.
And Jeff and I talked about that in our podcast
Yeah,
yesterday.
we talked about that yesterday. I mean, we've lost focus. The focus is so much on academic outcomes
Right.
that and that finished product that we're not focusing on the process of development the way we should be.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So Stephanie, listeners are really going to want to hear about this. So it's the 80s. What was your shoulder pad situation? Were you wearing things with the built-in shoulder pads in them? Was that did you have big
Did.
shoulders?
I liked shoulder pads. I mean, but as somebody who was working, let's talk about my career. I was working with adjudicated teenagers, didn't wear shoulder pads much there. I was working with young children. So I did have shoulder pads in my good clothes, but most of the time I was in jeans and t-shirts. So
Not able to wear the shoulder pads with it's one of
intermittent
my
shoulder pads there,
it's one of
yeah.
my takeaway from the 80s was the shoulder pads. Tamar, what was your shoulder pad situation in
Oh
the 80s?
yeah, I had
Yeah.
them all right. Oh, absolutely. But I remember one day when I took them out, I just couldn't stand them anymore.
Okay, no more shoulder pads. It
Yeah,
must have
I
been
just
very
took them out.
liberating. Must have been very liberating. So what happens next? You move from the teens back to the youngins.
Yeah, I kind of did some. I think the last time I worked with the teens was in the 90s as a certified teacher. I got emergency certification. So I went back and forth. I was the educational supervisor of the program. I did a lot of hopping around. I think I counted at one point that I had actually had 12 different jobs over a decade, and in between that had worked with younger children, gone back into child care. I had a couple of years where I worked in a public library in the children's room, where I really was able to immerse myself in folk and fairy tales, and did my dissert or my master's thesis on social development and fairy tales based in part of what I'd done with the kids. I had my own fairy tale newsletter. I had children. I had a family child care home for about 37 seconds, which was the hardest thing that I ever did in my life. And made me think.
I did the same thing.
I had three children under the age of 8 months, and I was like, "Oh my goodness, this is not, no, I can't do this." So it's mad respect for people who are successful family child care providers. So I jumped around a lot in and out of that whole thing, and then ended up getting deciding I should get certified to teach. I already had my master's in education, but I decided that maybe I was ready emotionally to go into a public school setting if I was lucky enough to get a job, which was very difficult in a rural area, but that and see if I could shake things up a little bit. So I went back and got the last few courses I needed to become certified, and was lucky enough to get a job teaching kindergarten in a public, in a rural public school district, and taught kindergarten, first grade, and then sixth grade in a public school district. And I guess when I think about what that was like, I mean, it was Stephanie bringing in all of Stephanie's stuff, and trying to be authentic to what I believed about child development there as well. And so there was a lot of play. I actually had kindergarten. I had parents ask for their children to be removed from my kindergarten class because I didn't provide worksheets, and that Mrs. Jones across the street or across the hall, like, she did five worksheets every day their children had, and now they were in my classroom, and maybe they got one or two a week, and they weren't real worksheets. They were ones that I had obviously made myself, and that was not what they wanted. And so, yeah, I mean, it's the same thing happened in first grade. The most fun thing I did in first, I mean, first, I love teaching first grade because you just got to see these kids learning how to read. It was just like this pop, 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 pop. It was so exciting. But I knew that they needed to play. And so I created a thing called Town that we played during the winter. This is Northwestern Pennsylvania. So lots of times we couldn't get them out for recess. They were all, Jeff, you and I have talked about the baby bear play, the rough and tumble play. They needed something different than any kind of even my emergent adapted curriculum. And so I took the standards at the time and I mapped out how letting them play twice a week, all afternoon, play town. We created our own town. They all had jobs. How it integrated all of their content areas of literacy and math and social studies and health. And I did this whole big web thing and presented it to the principal because I knew I was going to get in trouble. And he couldn't really say much about it because I was covering all the standards. So we played, and that was wonderful. Yeah.
But I'm sure there were people who wanted to be in your class.
There were people who wanted to be in my class.
They were enlightened.
They were enlightened, but they also saw that I really loved the kids. But again, that relationship was just very, very strong. And some of the parents really, they didn't care as long as there was something was happening with the kids. They were good. And my principal was for a while was open to letting me experiment. He offered the opportunity for us to, instead of using the X amount of hundreds of dollars to buy workbooks for the kids for literacy, he said, if anybody wants to use this money for other materials, I will allow you to do that. So I was able to buy lots and lots and lots of books and paper and stuff to set up a writing center and like a gazillion and a half staplers and hole punches and all of that stuff. My classroom always looked different than everybody else's. But yeah, I mean, people who were enlightened or people who didn't really pay attention were happy to have their kids in the classroom. And the kids went home happy. I mean, that was...
You said the principal was like that for a while. What happened?
The district pivoted to a different early literacy curriculum, mm-hmm. which I was a vocal opponent of because I thought it was stupid. And then it started to cause him problems because there was a really strong, he was not committed to my way of doing things. He was willing to allow me to do things my way because there was some part of him that thought, well, this is interesting at least. But once this ARL curriculum came down as the mandate and I started getting crankier and started mouthing off to the reading teacher and and telling her, these are not stories. I will not have children. I said, this makes no sense. How can you teach children to read when it makes no sense? I'm not anti-phonics, but this is not a good, anyway. He got increasingly a little bit uncomfortable. We also had volunteered. He asked for volunteers to do inclusion, and so I was one of there were I think nobody in second grade volunteered, but there was one teacher in each of the K through six who volunteered to do inclusion. This is before ID EA, but he knew it was coming, and so I had the first year six children with a wide variety of special needs in a class of 25. I did have a part-time aide, but they hadn't really the there was a push in the push in special ed teacher who didn't understand inclusion was it was not a good situation in any grade level, and especially first grade is really difficult, and they range the so it, things got a little bit hectic in my classroom at times because I had children with severe social and emotional challenges as well. So that was a little agitating. Parents were like, "Hey, you know, she's letting them play, and we've got these wacky kids in there that like are going around with rubber bands around their necks, and this child doesn't speak, and like, what's she doing to make things? She needs more control." So, sixth grade, it became increasingly difficult for me to do what I wanted to do joyfully with kids. And a sixth grade position opened up, and I was encouraged by the principal's wife, who was also a teacher in the school, to apply for it. Because she said, you know, Tom doesn't disagree with what you're doing, but it would be a lot easier for him if you were in sixth grade because sixth grade parents don't pay attention. And he's getting a lot of pressure from the parents that your strategies are just a little bit out there. So I taught sixth grade and played with them.
And that was acceptable.
Yeah, because as I have always been, since standards became what we had to follow, I think if we know the standards, if we really read them and understand them and know child development, you can walk the walk if you can talk the talk. And so I educated myself to be able to say, when these kids are like dressed in tights and acting out Robin Hood, here are all of the literacy and social studies objectives I am hitting. And they are reading, they are writing, they are speaking, they are listening, they are creating, they are doing all of these. I did the project approach with my sixth graders, and
Perfect.
it worked. Some of them had a little bit of trouble with math once they hit seventh grade. I will admit that. That wasn't my strong suit. But yeah, I think I felt as though I never have been able to not be authentic in what I believe about what's best for kids. And
But you know,
that's
I think children, even if they have a bit of problem with maths the next year, they have an attitude to learning that's different because
yes.
they've learned that learning is actually pleasurable with you. So they can kind of adapt that. Because
Yes.
I had parents also in my childcare center who were often worried because we had an emergent curriculum play curriculum throughout the center. With the preschool going to kindergarten, all that, and they some of the parents who were very anxious about that, they found that their kids did really well in school after because they liked learning, and time and again they'd come back to tell me, you know, it's going really well. We didn't realize that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that I have, through the wonders of social media and the internet, reconnected with a lot of the kids that I had both in first grade and in sixth grade as adults. I mean, they're parents now and everything. And consistently they've come back and told me themselves that they had such fond memories of being in my classroom, and they come up with like random things that they remember, like stories that I told to them or things that they did that were, I mean, they remembered like what role they'd played in when we played town. They're like, oh yeah, one young woman who's now a doctor. And I was like, were you a doctor when we played town? And she goes, oh no, I was a real estate agent because that was what my mom was at the time. And I, this, don't you remember? And I'm like, God, you're sorry. So I, you know, I, But I think in thinking about it, you know, when we're talking about the early childhood journey, I mean, I said all through last time, I'm privileged because I had a family that supported me in my own resilience and in my own, you know, I just was encouraged to act on what I believed in, and somehow had the privilege of being able to not to to have courage. And I think that like doing this stuff, I think really to fight it, you have to be resilient. You have to be brave. And that's not something that, I mean, I can attribute that to my life experiences, and I recognize that privilege, and that a lot of people don't have.
Yeah, because it probably gives you a sort of foundational understanding that things can work out.
Yes. And
Well,
that
a lot
I
of
think
people
a
don't have that. I mean, I don't have that. You
I
know,
think
I've
a
had
lot of
to
listeners are
learn
going to
it, and
relate to that situation where you found yourself trying to do your thing in your classroom and some moderate wavering support from the layer of bureaucracy directly above you and some pressure pushing down from the layer above that. That's where a lot of people that are trying to promote play-based early learning really find themselves. And so the fact that you struggled through it and were able to make it work for a time is a good model for folks.
yeah, again, it's courage, and you know, as Tamar said, like I recognize that a lot of people don't have it, and it's not something that's inherent in me. It was because of my life experiences that I was able to develop it. So I'm grateful, and I think that's why I've always felt like I need to keep fighting, because if I'm courageous enough to keep fighting, and I keep thinking that things can get better, then I have an obligation and a responsibility to use my best strengths to make things better if I can.
So what happens after sixth grade?
I moved across the state and started a new life. And not. And I ended up in as a center director, a service coordinator in early intervention, which was I mean, I've been strong inclusion even at working with the adjudicated teens. I was the ed supervisor who got kids into the public schools when they were ready. And so I have a strong passion for inclusion as a concept, but this was my first time to really do a deep dive into young children, 3 to 5 year olds who had special needs and a range of special needs, and understand that whole legal sphere. And I liked it a lot. I moved to an area where I have no geographic understanding of anything. Like right and left is complicated for me. And I got a job that was over an hour away from my home, which I didn't realize I took the job. And so it was a challenge. But then the opportunity came up to be the director at this magical preschool, the Children's School of Cabrini College, that I had worked in as my first job out of college. And I came back as director, and it was a wonderful experience, closer to home. And back, it was an inclusive center, but it wasn't it very play-based, very wonderful in many ways, and had the experience of leading it through reaccreditation and AC accreditation for the first time in some years, and learned a lot of stuff, but again, butted up a little bit. The college had taken a, it was functioned as a quasi lab school, but the college had become much more traditional in their educational approach. And so I had some butting of heads with the administration at the college about why, you know, what was our curriculum like? So we wrote this magnificent curriculum that was all child-centered, play-based, open-ended. And they were like, yeah, that's not a curriculum. And I was like, but it's what we do. Anyway, so that was lots of opportunities for growth, a lot of good learning. And then,
That's called reframing.
Oh, yeah, plenty of stories there. But what I realized being a director was that I could do it. I mean, and I thought I was, I was fine. But I really, what my downside as a director was that what I really wanted to do was to be on the floor playing with kids. I loved the multi-age aspect of the program. I loved the open-endedness of it. I loved every part of the teaching piece of it. And anytime I didn't have somebody on the phone or I didn't have something to do, I would like sneak into the classrooms and play with the kids. And I recognize if I really have, if it was this teaching piece of it that brought me joy, then maybe I needed to find another opportunity to teach because it was such a different way. My brain w had to be very, very different when I was doing the director stuff than when I was doing the working with children stuff. And so I saw an ad in the paper for an opportunity to teach at a community college, at Montgomery County Community College in education. And I thought, well, what the heck? It's that's the teaching stuff. Let me see if I can possibly get that job. And I was lucky enough to get a full-time teaching job at the community college. And basically, although I went to a different one across the state, some years, 3 years later, that's where I ended my career, was teaching education and early education and child development at community colleges.
Yeah, because you know
And oh,
when you're in
yeah,
a
I'm sorry.
classroom, I'm sorry, Jeff,
No,
when
you
you're in the
go ahead.
classroom, you reach, 25 children, whatever. But when you're teaching teachers, you reach many children.
Yeah. And I loved it. I like when I walked onto the campus the day that I had my interview, I thought, this is it. This is where you've been pointed your whole life. This is going to be, and 20 some years later, that's the profession I retired from, was teaching at a community college. And now you're
So
doing podcasts with Jeff.
now my podcast
boy, you've really come down in the world.
Jeff.
So in
No, because then you reach people too.
yeah they, I
Yes.
mean, you're reaching tens of people,
Tens?
at least 10, 20 people listen to this show at least.
I think more than 10.
Maybe a few. In a decade plus of this show, I regularly hear from people who are in early learning education programs, some version of, Jeff, I'm in my second or third year of college and nobody's mentioned play yet. Did you ever talk about play when you were teaching early learning people?
Yes, I talked about play with the early learning people. I talked about play with the elementary people, and I talked about play with the secondary people that I worked with. I mean, as I said, I have had a hard time not being authentic to what I believe about child development my whole life. And so, yes, play was 100% what I lived, breathed, and did. Both is talking about it, but also acting it out. I mean, we played all the time in my classrooms. I was really lucky, not so much at Montgomery County Community College, which was a wonderful program, but when I went to Pittsburgh at the Community College of Allegheny County, it was actually the program was started by a man who had graduated from Pitt's Applied Developmental Psychology program. Mr. Rogers was his roommate when they were young, like the Mr. Rogers. So I entered a program that was 1000% not geared towards education, early education, but early development, and had Mr. Rogers as kind of like the fairy godfather who, I mean, it's portrait was he was on our board for a long time until a couple of years before he passed away. So it was again like pure luck, just like boom, here you are. So I had nothing to fight about with that program about child development. And when Pennsylvania pivoted their certification to pre-K through grade 4 instead of K through 6 in the sometime in the 2012, 2013 or whenever.
Right.
We decided we should change the name of our program. We were working on articulation agreements with four-year schools, and we held on to the development. It was the ECD program because it was early education. So we had one E that counted for early education, and child development was the C and the D, because nobody wanted to lose that developmental focus and in the program, which I really am grateful for and respect. I mean, Tamar, you were saying that they ditched child development, our program, because of its roots. Was able to hold on to that. And I believe still is, probably a little bit lessening now, but I think that's really important. My classroom was set up as a preschool classroom. I had all wonderful, we had blocks. We had everything that we could possibly want to have our students, many of whom were already in the field, enact, like do what they would be doing with children. And
I mean, I was the sole early childhood person in our college, and it was elementary ed, very focused. And so they were getting all that structured stuff and lesson planning and all that. They were getting it in spades. I mean, just so much of it. And so my courses, which I taught, were just completely play-based, relationships, social, emotional, you know, diversity. And I just did that, and they would call me in, the dean would call me in, and I was chair of the whole department at the time too, and she'd say, are you doing lesson plans with them? And I said, oh, absolutely, you know, but I never did one. Not one. I was there 13 years, and all the early childhood majors, or minors these days, they're called minors actually, not all, but a ton of them are still in touch with me, remember those classes, have taken some of the ideas with them. They can't always implement what they want to implement, but it was so important. I mean, Lord knows what's going on now.
Yeah.
Well, obviously, all the changes they made have fixed the education system, because kids are out there just fucking thriving today. No, I guess they're not, huh?
I would cry. I would go visit my student teachers in these structured classrooms, and I'd go home and cry. I mean, just sit there so despondent. I mean, I would talk to my student teachers the same way when we would sort of process stuff at the end, but there was nothing I could do to combat what they had to work with. It was awful.
How did the system get so broken?
Structure seems very important for testing. And we got a test to prove that we're okay.
And well, it goes kind of back to what Stephanie and I talked about in a previous episode. There's more focus on conformity and compliance than there is on development. And we want them to be good little well-behaved, stand in line, don't touch the walls when you're walking down the hallway, kind of little automatons. And we want them to be free-thinking people, because free-thinking people have ideas that might not correspond with everybody else's ideas, and that gets messy. It's hard to have a society when people have their own ideas.
It's dangerous for autocrats to have people with their own ideas. That's what's very troubling.
That's big picture that troubles me the most, and I think that that's a huge piece of it. But I keep coming back to the idea that education as a field, not so much even early education, but education, that umbrella, really doesn't, I mean, at some point we decided that theory wasn't important, that development wasn't important, that the old dead white guys had nothing to say to anybody, and threw the whole thing out. And I think that now you have people teaching at the college, teaching teachers who don't have that strong developmental background. They went through a traditional education program and took a couple of psychology classes in child development, but that's different from really understanding that Piaget is more than four stages, and that Vygotsky is more than scaffolding, and that all of these rich theories, many, not that they were all 100% right about everything, but that there were pieces that we've now, through neuroscience, really confirmed that it's important to understand. And I just, I mean, to me, that's been something I, because I'm just a, I love, I've always loved theory. I mean, people called me when Piaget died as like to give me their condolences. Not that I ever knew him, but I just feel like we've thrown out a lot of really, really important developmental concepts as we've moved forward. And there's nothing, I mean, we all want children to learn how to read and do math. Of course we do. That's never been something that anybody would say that's not important. But we just seem to we've lost the developmental piece, as Jeff and I were talking about.
And we've created if they learn how to read and do math in a manner that makes them not like reading and doing math, right, we end up with young adults who don't want to read or do math. And that ends up kind of, I mean, that's hard to have a society that way too.
Yeah. And I think that.
Yeah. I mean, Bruce Perry calls us a child illiterate society. And I really think that's become very true today.
I agree. And I think we, like, even now there's this big resurgence in, like, suddenly we've discovered social and emotional development. Ugh, really? Isn't that what makes us human? But it's now a thing. But, you know, if you look at that, it's packaged curriculums. I saw something on some social media site this morning with like, you know, like pictures of all of these little, and it was anti this, but you know, you show a kid a facial expression on a popsicle stick and say, identify this emotion. I mean, that has nothing to do with social and emotional development and how complex and how beautiful and how complicated it is for each one of us. And I, you know, it's, I mean, the whole money thing and who's making, who can have, you know, how can we make money off of our great ideas? I think it just gets back to, it's not like social emotional development is really anything too new. I don't think so.
Yeah. It's been kind of a human thing for at least a few years.
Well, the book after book on social development has nothing about the teacher's emotions and how they deal with their own emotions. Nothing. Mm-hmm. I was just asked to revise a chapter for a publisher that wasn't mine, to help sort of for a new edition. Mm-hmm. And it was all about social emotional, and it was all very practical, including those popsicle sticks kind of thing. Nothing about what happens to teachers when they're working with children. Nothing at all. I just said to them, sorry, could you find someone else for this chapter, yeah, please?
And then we wonder why there's, I mean, the last numbers I was able to find is it hovers around 30 to 40% of burnout, of people, yes, leaving the profession are due to burnout, yes, related issues because that piece isn't taken into consideration.
Yeah, it's such a problem. It's such a problem.
Well, we sure have gotten depressing and stand at the end of this episode.
Yes,
Stephanie.
No, I'm not doing that in a row.
You're such a hopeful person, Stephanie. Give us hope.
Well, I believe in fairy tales. And I think resilience is this umbrella. Jeff and I have talked a lot about it. And the neuroscience of neurodevelopmental resilience is something that is a concept that could unify a lot of these loose threads that we have. I'm passionate about it. I'm going to continue to like push forward with it. I think that if you look at the ancient stories, it's not like there have never been dragons before, and we can overcome them. And we have so much wonderful knowledge available. And I think that just helping people to reframe it that as yeah, things are tough. But you know what? Like, as tough as things are right now, were they not as tough back in the Middle
Right.
Ages? I mean, no,
Right.
of course not. Like, there were different trauma, different dangers, but not less. And I believe that we are resilient as a species, and that we need to start really paying attention to resilience as our primary focus in education and early childhood. And there's research that shows us how to do it in a relationship-based, play-based, child-centered, and that pays attention to what's going on. I don't think you can, I do a lot of workshops on resilience, and you can't listen to understand resilience without looking at yourself and saying, you know, am I, what factors of resilience do I have? What do I need? And which of these protective factors do I, as a classroom teacher, need to bring into my own life more? And how do I do that? And I, so that's my, that's my, that's my, that's my optimism that I think we just need to really refocus on the develop on resilience as a developmental concept, as one piece. I mean, it's a tiny piece of the puzzle, but I think it's a good umbrella that gives, I think I've always fought, and you guys probably always have too, against the idea that play and social and emotional development are the soft pieces of what we do, and like math and reading, and those are like that's the real stuff. And I think that pulling on neuroscience and stuff, Bruce Perry's work, I mean, there's so much great work on social and emotional development that's going on out there, and saying, yeah, actually, no, this is not the soft stuff. This is the core stuff.
Right.
Everything else will come from that. And we've always known that. Those of us who are play advocates have said that for a gazillion years. But now let's start harnessing that science, and being bullied. How's that?
Yeah. Well,
I don't.
I'm heading into my 75th year, and people are still bringing me to talk about this, so that gives me hope. Because I'm an old gal. What are they, there's so many wonderful young people out there doing wonderful things, and they bring me in to talk about relationships, well, more than that, but, and it gives me hope. That gives me hope that there are a lot of young people bringing me out to talk. Not a lot, but, and it makes me feel okay. They, like you said, they, not, it's not all thrown away.
Yeah, and maybe, Jeff and I were talking yesterday about like a lot of what young people are saying too is great, and social media expands that reach
Yep.
beyond what it could. So I think being able to continue to talk and put it out there, I keep going through this. I went back for my doctorate at age 59, and wrote published my first, maybe probably only, book at when I was 66. And so there's, I think it we need all need to those of us who believe in this all need to continue to look at, like, if you have the energy to do it, keep doing it. And if you don't have the energy, like, is there someone who can help you and develop
Just a
that?
little story about Bruce Perry before we end, actually. I used to take him places to present because I was like a
With his
groupie.
consent?
Oh yeah.
Okay. I thought you were just showing up in
And
his driveway and.
his I wouldn't call it an agent, but the person who I would work with to bring him out to wherever said to me, at the end of his presentations, get him out of there because people come and ask him specific questions for hours, and he's so kind that he'll just talk to them and he'll miss his plane or whatever. So you have to get him out of there. So he had talked for 3 hours in this conference at in Philadelphia, and at the end of the 3 hours, I was packing him up to get him to go to the airport, and a young woman, rushes in and she said, "I missed this, but I've got to tell my director what it was about. Can you just tell me what you talked about?" And I sort of looked at her like, are you kidding? I mean, it was a 3-hour presentation. And he's packing up. And I said, well, you know, Dr. Perry has to go now. He can't talk to you now. And he goes very quietly, he says, just tell her it's relationships, relationships, relationships. And I never forgot that. In fact, that's one of my chapters. That's the title of the chapter.
And I think that's, you know, we all know relationships. And I think that if that message can be the one that we continue to share and help teachers and parents know that that's what is the heart of being human, and that's what is the heart of any educational experience, that's what's going to make it work. Maybe we can be able to focus on that and have
Hey,
our
sounds like that.
happily ever afters.
Live a happily ever after. I'm going to continue to be joyfully cynical. A little bit of housekeeping as we wrap this up. Listeners, if any of you want to share your early learning journey, listener Pam, I'd like to get in touch with me. I think you're brave enough to do this. And anybody else, hook up with me. You can email me. You can find me at myplayhaven.com. We're looking for some more people to chat with about their journey through the profession. Also, if you're looking for chatting opportunities, you can join me for happy hour, Childcare Barn Girl happy hour, the fourth Tuesday of the month, 7:30 p.m. Central Time. There is a registration link in the show notes. Stephanie, a while ago you mentioned tights and Robin Hood, and I wanted to throw in that's just date night here at the Snuggery. This has been the Child Care Bar and Grill podcast, the world's longest running and most prolific early learning podcast. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
This has been an Explorations Early Learning Upstairs Studio production.